Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. As a litany of reports come streaming in from reliable, independent sources that corroborate what the Western mainstream news outlets are reporting about the sheer brutality of the Russian assault on Ukraine, it would be tempting to hop aboard the We Stand With Ukraine bandwagon. And by that, I don't mean simply joining the impressively united world condemnation of the invasion, but rather the virtual cheerleading that has been encouraged by the Western media that comes with certain distortions and omissions with regard to the history of the region and, in particular, with regard to the U.S. role there. I've been saying for weeks that while Russia's Vladimir Putin is the clear aggressor, having invaded a sovereign nation without justification and thus violating international law, he's not the only hegemon in the equation. The United States' apparent mission to surround Russia with NATO initiates has been a clear provocation and one of the short list of grievances on Putin's part that are clearly reasonable and legitimate. And regardless of what you may think of Putin and his state apparatus, I personally have a very low opinion of him and would like to see him deposed and prosecuted, the fact remains that prior to this illegal invasion, Putin clearly expressed his grievances and even offered a couple of treaties that codified them. Those were rejected by the United States, even as Ukraine seemed willing to negotiate. Now that the invasion has begun and there have been opportunities to negotiate a settlement, those too have been disregarded by the Western powers, who seem intent instead to supply more and more weapons to Ukraine, thus virtually guaranteeing the furtherance of bloodshed. To hear alternative or divergent points of view, even from Ukrainians, one has to turn to independent media. There, what you hear is that the conflict is a proxy war between the U.S. and Russia, and there's also been a little discussion of outcomes and what comes after if the Russian invasion is successful, producing a regime change in Ukraine and preventing Ukraine from joining NATO. What will the Western powers do next? If Russia is repulsed and the U.S. prevails, leaving the current Ukrainian government intact, and what will become of the social and economic reforms there? Will the white nationalist movement be emboldened and gain proportional power? In today's program, we have two segments offering different views, one set fill in some of the details and the history that the obedient mainstream media outlets aren't offering. One is from a somewhat dubious source, a news outlet based in Belarus, which is a close ally of Russia, and another from a perennially reliable source, Pacifica Radio veteran producer Doug Henwood. Both are interviews with American university professors. I offer them here as food for thought.
Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today. First, a seasoned Behind the News guest, Anatole Levin, discussing, no surprise here, Ukraine. And then Alyssa Giacchino and Derek Seidman will talk about the role of private equity in destroying the climate. In February 1997, the 93-year-old George Kennan, one of the architects of the Cold War policy of containment to the USSR, wrote this in the New York Times. Expanding NATO would be the most fateful error of American foreign policy in the entire post-Cold War era. Such a decision may be expected to inflame the nationalistic, anti-Western, and militaristic tendencies in Russian opinion, to have an adverse effect in the development of Russian democracy, to restore the atmosphere of the Cold War to East-West relations, and to impel Russian foreign policy in directions decidedly not to our liking. Why, with all the hopeful possibilities engendered by the end of the Cold War, should East-West relations become centered on the question of who would be allied with whom and by implication against whom in some fanciful, totally unforeseeable, and most improbable future military conflict? The disaster he foretold is upon us. To help us understand all this, here's Anatole Levin. In the 1980s and 90s, Levin covered the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and the wars in Afghanistan, Chechnya, and the Southern Caucasus for the Financial Times and the Times of London. In the 2000s, he worked at a number of think tanks in Washington and is now a senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Anatole Levin. This war is just horribly brutal, and everyone I know is in a terrible state of mind over it. But it didn't come out of nowhere. What George Kennan worried about 25 years ago has pretty much come to pass.
Well, exactly. Since the mid-1990s, when the issue of NATO enlargement first came out, Russian officials, Russian intellectuals, and leading Western experts, including George Kennan, the architect of containment, and myself, in a small way, have all been saying that if this were extended one day to Ukraine and Georgia, it would lead at best to deep confrontation and at worst to war. The Yeltsin administration warned of this. This is not just a Putin thing. And Putin has been warning of it consistently. And of course, over the past almost 3 months by now, before the war, the Russian government was making clear that there was a threat of war if the West did not compromise on what Russia regarded as its vital interests. The Russian government has, well, obviously it's committed a very grave crime under international law by invading Ukraine. I think it's also made a terrible mistake. But as you say, in international relations, one also has to take account of realities. And, you know, the reality is that Russia has always regarded keeping Ukraine out of a hostile Western alliance as vital to Russian national security.
How much infiltration or manipulation of the political scene in Ukraine has the U.S. and other Western powers been guilty of? Has there been conscious subversion? Are the Russians rightly paranoid about that, or are they just getting carried away?
In 2014, I mean, it was obvious from funding, including by institutions that are rather comically in America called non-governmental institutions, even though they're funded by Congress, like the National Endowment for Democracy, to the Ukrainian opposition, made clear the West's desire to overthrow the then elected, by the way, government of Ukraine, President Yanukovych. And obviously there was the famous intercepted telephone conversation by Victoria Nuland, which made clear the role of the Obama administration in manipulating the formation of the next Ukrainian government. Since then, it hasn't been exactly a matter of covert manipulation, but, you know, the West has aided Ukraine, has strongly encouraged Ukraine to try to join the Western alliance, while not actually offering Ukraine membership or anything but the vaguest possibility of membership in future. And of course, the West has funded, educated, supported large numbers of the Ukrainian elites. But this is not covert manipulation. You know, this is overt. You can say Ukraine's development towards free market democracy, which is quite true. But I mean, it is obviously also an attempt to turn Ukraine into a Western ally. If the West, you know, as it's done in some other places, had supported democracy in Ukraine and economic reform, but without raising this for 12 years now, they've had no intention of actually implementing, but, you know, suggesting this idea of Ukraine joining NATO. You know, if we'd stuck to the one without introducing the other, maybe this catastrophe could have been avoided.
Yeah, I noticed you said in the Prospect interview that we never had the slightest intention of defending Ukraine, not the slightest. Now, was that ever expressed? Did the Ukrainians understand it? Did they not hear it? Were they not told it?
I think they must have understood it more or less, or at least sensible Ukrainians did. Because after all, we'd done the same thing to Georgia in 2008, you know, when there was this half promise of NATO membership, but when this led to war with Russia, well, actually, Georgians attacked the Russians in South Ossetia. Of course, America never came to Georgia's aid, and the West didn't come to Ukraine's aid in 2014. But there are two problems, really. One is that for a long time now, I mean, really ever since the 1990s, we have made membership of NATO and the European Union synonymous with belonging to Europe. That has two problems. The first is that it makes it virtually impossible for democratic reformers anywhere in Eastern Europe not to try to join the EU and NATO, because they are basically branding themselves as second-class Europeans or non-Europeans. So the option, which was entirely viable in itself, of joining Finland and Austria as free market democracies, but non-aligned ones, we morally and emotionally and politically speaking closed that door. But the second thing, of course, was that by defining Europe in these terms and going in for this NATO rhetoric of Europe whole and free, we told the Russians completely explicitly, you're not Europeans, go away. We don't consider you part of Europe and we're not going to consult you about European affairs. Well, you know, that is about as deep an insult to Russia as one can easily imagine. And, you know, it was not going to go down well with any Russian government, let alone Putin's.
What are Putin's goals here? Do we have any idea? Does he really believe Ukraine is a fiction, or more of a fiction than most nations are? Does he want a buffer zone? Complete absorption? What's the end game?
Well, the answer is I don't know. In fact, I mean, the striking thing is, you know, I've been talking to, you can imagine, quite a lot of members of what you might call the outer Russian establishment. And they were all, without exception, surprised by many aspects of this Russian invasion. And they all said that now the decision-making circle in Russia, in the Russian government, and the circle of people who Putin actually listens to, has narrowed to fewer than 10 people. It's become very, very, very closed.
Those pictures of him at that gigantic table are capturing something, aren't they?
Yeah, well, and of course, COVID, as many people say, I think, has made this worse. But as a result, I mean, you could say, a bit like US administrations in the run-up to Vietnam and Iraq, but much more so, it seems likely that Putin has, in fact, been cut off or cut himself off from accurate and objective information. All I can say is that if Putin was, and his immediate followers, if they were so incredibly stupid as to believe that they could impose a puppet government on the whole of Ukraine, then, you know, unless they're blind as well as mad, they must realize that the strength of Ukrainian resistance and, you know, the display of Ukrainian unity since the war began, you know, have rendered that completely impossible. This isn't Czechoslovakia or Hungary during the Cold War, where you at least had the structures of a communist party to maintain Soviet domination. You will not be able to create anything but the most grotesque, ridiculous, obvious puppet authority in Kiev, if that's what Putin wants. It will lack all legitimacy. It will be totally incapable of running a stable state. It will face continual protests and resistance, which will have to be put down by ruthless means, and it will necessitate the permanent presence of a Russian army to keep it in place, you know, just like the Soviet Union or America in Afghanistan. The war so far has clarified some things. One thing it's clarified is that although, you know, NATO has imposed harsh economic sanctions, as I say, NATO will not fight for Ukraine, which of course makes the idea of Ukrainian NATO membership completely empty. Ukraine might as well give that up and sign a treaty of neutrality. But on the other hand, I think it has completely destroyed Russian plans, if that's what they were, to impose a puppet government. I mean, not just in Ukraine, but even in most of the Russian-speaking areas of Ukraine. Because apart from anything else, as is now apparent, I mean, to capture the cities in Ukraine, Russia will, you know, it can't just walk in. The Ukrainians will fight back very hard. And in the process, of course, large parts of these cities will be destroyed. And large numbers of wretched civilians will be killed. Well, how can you possibly set up a pro-Russian government on the basis of that? So I wonder, I mean, it does look as if the Russians are going to storm Kharkov, and, well, they're attacking Mariupol and in the south. But I wonder, as far as Kiev is concerned, you know, Kiev being by far the biggest Ukrainian city, whether Putin has made up his mind yet actually to storm it. Or whether he is aiming to blockade Kiev in an effort to put pressure on the Ukrainian government to make peace on, you know, some version of Russian terms, perhaps not full Russian terms. We don't know how far Russia will compromise on its terms. We'll have to see. But as I say, I mean, I think the maximal Russian aim in Ukraine, thank God, has already been defeated by the Ukrainian people and army.
How long can that go on?
This is beginning to take on aspects of Chechnya in 1994 to 96, which I covered as a British journalist on both sides. Or even in a way, one could say, the American invasion of Iraq, which is to say, I don't know how much the Russian army as a whole was really behind this invasion. You know, there are suggestions that, once again, the bulk of the generals were not consulted, and certainly some of them have looked extremely unhappy on television. But, you know, when an army is in a war, particularly a war of this kind of importance to Russia, they want to win. And, of course, Putin cannot leave Ukraine without the appearance of at least, you know, a limited success, or I think he would actually be finished. I think there would be some form of coup against him from within the regime. So I have this horrible feeling that, you know, if they can't get a peace agreement which allows them, you know, to claim a measure of success, that they will feel that they have no choice but to go on. you know, irrespective of the destruction and the civilian casualties. And then, of course, once they've occupied large areas of Ukraine, well, I mean, in the end, there will always have to be a negotiated settlement of some kind. The importance of Ukraine to Russia is so great that the Russians, I don't think any Russian government, you know, I hope very much that Putin will be overthrown as a result of this, but I don't believe that any Russian government will simply withdraw from Ukraine, you know, as a whole and give up Crimea and the Donbass Republic. So Russia will not withdraw from Ukraine the way that, you know, the Soviet Union or America withdrew from Afghanistan. So in the end, there will always have to be some form of negotiated solution by which Russia withdraws. And, you know, my own view is we should all seek a negotiated solution now, because it may be that in 10 years' time, I don't know, 20 years' time, we will get basically the same solution that we could have got today. The difference, of course, will be tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian lives.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin, Senior Research Fellow on Russia and Europe at the Quincy Institute. What about the nuclear threats? I mean, I find myself being nostalgic for the Soviet leadership, which at least seemed somewhat rational. Is Putin that unhinged that these should be taken seriously?
No, I don't think so. I mean, this, you know, given that Russia does have either the largest or the second largest nuclear arsenal in the world, and he knows, you know, for very good reasons that people are scared of nuclear war, it's crazy in one way. I mean, by, you know, in a rational world, it would be crazy. But of course, we don't live in a rational world. In the actual world, it's an obvious weapon for Russia to brandish to frighten the West. But that doesn't mean that he's going to launch a nuclear attack, and nor, of course, are we. But what I worry about more is that if we get into a state of permanent deep tension, we have a guerrilla war on Russia's borders, you know, probably overlapping into terrorism in Russia itself, backed by the West through Poland. The level of tension and the potential for armed clashes will be such, you know, as has not existed in Europe between Moscow and the West since basically the Berlin airlift blockade of 1948. And in those circumstances, you know, of heightened tension and fear on both sides, there is always the possibility of some disastrous accident or miscalculation. We really need to remember the number of times which have now come out when, by accident, there could have been a nuclear exchange during the Cold War. Several times it came down to the wisdom and caution of one man on either side, one man, you know. So, you know, just because Putin is not going to deliberately fire missiles at us doesn't mean that the, you know, the threat isn't really genuinely there.
What about the Western reaction? Are sanctions that effective? And now we hear some yahoos on cable TV talking about attacking the Russians, declaring no-fly zones. What about the Western reaction? How much can we do?
I haven't noticed that any of these people calling for no-fly zones are going to be flying US and NATO planes themselves. As far as I can see, there are no pilots among them, right? As I've said again several times in recent days, chicken hawks don't fly. They squat on the ground at a very safe distance and squawk loudly. No, I mean, sanctions is what we've got, basically. Plus, I think this is a terrible idea, by the way, but I fear support for a Ukrainian insurgency against Russia, if, of course, Russia occupies areas where such an insurgency can be launched. Now, as to the effectiveness of these sanctions, well, I mean, obviously, what the West is trying to do is to hurt Russia as badly as possible without hurting the West. And, of course, in this case, particularly the Europeans, who are dependent on Russia for energy imports. You know, we've sanctioned everything we possibly can, short of cutting off the gas and oil. So, I mean, that being so, Russia will still have an international revenue stream. But on the other hand, you know, the sanctions that have been imposed will hit Russia very badly, and I think are harsher than Russia expected, particularly the sanctions, you know, against Russian central bank, and will lead to Russia's isolation from at least the Western economies, except in the area of energy. In addition, the measures introduced by the West and the countermeasures introduced by Russia will hit very badly the international lifestyles of the Russian elites, and especially the younger elites to which they've become accustomed. This doesn't affect the inner circle around Putin. I mean, these are hard men, as they say in Ireland. They are undoubtedly deeply patriotic in their own sense, and they are very, very determined and resolute, and of course, completely ruthless. But I think it's worth remembering that, you know, in the 1980s, as the children of the Soviet elites became aware of how much better they could live in a westernized Russia, for pretty cynical reasons, I have to say, in many cases, but still, than they were in a Soviet Russia, that played a huge part in the fall of communism and the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And, you know, if you are plugged in to the wider Russian elites and listening to what they're saying in private, but actually what some of them have even started to say in public, you do see that they are becoming really anxious. And of course, they understand better than the rest of the population, even the educated population, just how badly this is going to affect them. If this goes on over a long period, you know, and the Ukrainian quagmire goes on for a long period, then I think discontent against Putin will mount very, very high. If it mounts high enough, look, one doesn't know, but I think it's more likely than, you know, a revolution on the streets like in Ukraine in 2014 or Georgia. I think more likely would be a coup from within the Putin regime, basically to get rid of him and some other top officials. Perhaps, you know, it could be a relatively polite coup. You know, a delegation goes to him and says very politely, you know, we respect your record, we guarantee your property and your personal security and that of your family, but it's time to go. But as I've said, I don't think that any Russian government that succeeds Putin will simply surrender unconditionally in Ukraine, you know, in the sense of giving up Crimea and the Donbass and acceding to Ukrainian NATO membership and giving up any guarantees for the Russian minority in Ukraine. I find it very difficult to believe that you know, unless Russia actually collapses as a state, that any Russian government will agree to that. Now, I'm very afraid, looking at some of the voices in America now, that a good many people in the American security establishment do now want to use this to destroy Russia as a state. But in the first place, that, you know, condemns us to endless economic warfare against Russia, with everything that would mean for the world economy. It condemns Ukraine to endless war, with horrible suffering for the Ukrainian people. But also, of course, a program of sanctions which is openly aimed at what many Russians would see as not just getting rid of Putin, but destroying the Russian state, could have the completely opposite result as far as the support of Russians for the regime. We just don't know. But I mean, what we do know is that similar sanctions aimed at regime change in Cuba, in Iraq, in Venezuela, in Iran, in North Korea have all failed, all of them, without exception. And so all one can say is, look, it could be different in the case of Russia, but there are no historical grounds to believe this.
Now, who is Putin's power base? Who surrounds him? Does he have a constituency in the elite, or is it pretty much a small little clique of cronies?
Well, I mean, the thing is that Putin has assembled a wider establishment, which is beholden to him in many ways, you know, and he has tamed what remains of the old financial and economic oligarchy and gained their public support. But you know, these people are extremely cynical and self-interested and ruthless. They will not stick with Putin if they think that, you know, their own vital interests are in danger, or that sticking with Putin is going to mean that, you know, their own fortunes and positions will be destroyed. The inner circle, the people who are completely beholden to Putin, or not perhaps exactly beholden to Putin, but are completely identify with Putin, who have exactly the same background and ideology, are a very small group of mainly ex-KGB people, or linked to the KGB in various ways. And they occupy all the top positions in at least on the security side in government. And also they've been put in control of Russia's, a large part of Russia's energy economy and various other places. So there's quite a sharp difference between this small inner group of, they're called the Siloviki in Russian, the men of force, or as I say, the hard men, and the wider establishment. And I suppose one question is whether any of this inner circle will turn against Putin. I mean, if enough of them do, then it's over for him. But on the other hand, they're so closely associated with him, they're so closely associated with the war, that it would be very difficult for them to do so. Then, of course, there is the question of the Russian army. Now, the Russian army, like the Soviet army before it, has never been involved in politics. And also, you know, they don't want to lose in Ukraine. You know, if you get an endless quagmire, then at the very least, they may start, you know, really, really pressing for a diplomatic compromise to get out of Ukraine. If, of course, the Ukrainians and the West are prepared to offer a compromise. Because, you know, there's one issue that people haven't looked at yet, but the Ukrainians are trying to call up basically, you know, all their men of military age. How many they'll get, it depends on how much territory Russia conquers. It depends on how many Ukrainians flee to the West. But even so, I mean, if Ukraine calls up everybody it possibly can, it will in fact hugely outnumber the existing Russian army in Ukraine. Now, if the Russians in response have to call up their reservists, you know, here we're talking about, you know, ex-conscripts who served and then left the army and now have jobs and have families. You know, if you start telling 28-year-old Russians to leave their well-paid jobs and their children and return to fight in Ukraine, a war that they were never consulted about, and where they've been watching, you know, pictures, very demoralizing pictures of Russian Ukrainians, Russian speaking women and children being killed. That, I think, is the moment when, if it has to do that, then the Putin regime will be in really serious trouble, if it has to call up a large part of the Russian population to fight. And I think at that point, Putin would have signed his political death warrant.
And finally, we're seeing China now stepping in, possibly into a peacekeeping role. How much of all this reflects the decline of U.S. power and prestige, and is there anything to this talk of a Russia-China alliance?
Just as, you know, the West has not fought for Ukraine, so China has not actually officially sided with Russia in Ukraine. It abstained in the UN Security Council. It has stressed, you know, respect for international law and international sovereignty. And we don't yet know how far China will go in supporting Russia economically. This will be very, very expensive for the Chinese. And they would also drive an extremely hard bargain in terms of redirecting Russian energy exports to China to guarantee, you know, China's energy security. So it seems to me that China is not actually so far trying to exploit this crisis as much as it might have. If China would step in and broker a reasonable compromise, this would be an excellent thing, because I don't trust the United States to do so, to be honest, given the strength of the anti-Russian agendas here and the desire of some people actually to turn this into a permanent war to destroy Russia. So I think it would be an excellent thing if the Chinese stepped in, but I also know that America would do everything in its power to block a Chinese brokered agreement. As to the decline of American power, it is striking just how distorted the view of the world of many establishment Americans has become over the past 30 years. Even after the failure in Iraq and Afghanistan and the rise of China and, you know, the failure to pacify the Middle East and the disaster that followed the intervention in Libya, you know, there still is this idea around that one heard so often in the 90s and well into the 2000s that basically America can do anything, anywhere. Doug, we're both old enough, right, you know, to remember back before the end of the Cold War. Now, if you think back 35 years, if you had said to anybody, and I mean anybody in a Western position of authority or any serious intellectual, that the West should support a war in Ukraine, not take part in it, but support it, for the sake of Ukraine joining NATO, theoretically, and turning Ukraine into a full military ally of the West against Russia. You know, even the hardest line Western, you know, anti-communist hawks would have laughed their heads off. They'd have said, you must be mad. You know, we don't have the resources to do that. That will lead to actual war with Moscow. Don't forget they have thousands of nuclear missiles. And by the and in any case, how could this possibly be in our interest if we can, you know, to take such an appalling risk and make such a commitment? If we can, you know, manage to get not just the Poles and the Czechs and the Hungarians, but to rescue the Balts from the Soviet Union and free them and turn them into Western allies, well, this would be a, you know, a magnificent, a historic, a wonderful Western victory.
It's rollback, right?
Yeah, I mean, but you surely people would have said, you can't be suggesting we should go further than that. Well, now, of course, we've spent years thinking that we could go further than that, and the result has been disaster.
That's Anatole Levin, Senior Research Fellow on Russia and Europe at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. The Institute is based in D.C. Levin is based in London. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
That was a segment from Doug Henwood's weekly syndicated program from Pacifica Radio called Behind the News. Now let's hear a segment from another American professor from a Belarusian outlet.
Belarus across the globe in 9 languages, 24/7, online, FM, and satellites. Radio Belarus International, bringing Belarus closer.
Russia and Ukraine hold their first negotiations. The two sides have identified a number of priority topics on which certain solutions have been outlined. As Belarusian Foreign Minister Vladimir Makey stressed, these negotiations are exceptionally important because they may begin a process which will prevent the emergence of a Slavonic spring. The outcomes of these negotiations, as well as the current situation in Ukraine, we are discussing now with political analyst Gilbert Doctorow. Gilbert, the negotiations between Ukraine and Belarus have already started, and it's great that the sides sat down for talks. The results of this dialogue have been met with cautious optimism. At least the sides could find contact points. How could you comment on that?
I think it's very important that Belarus made available to both parties its center in near Gomel for purposes of negotiation. However, the nature of those negotiations has to be understood in a specific context. The context is that Russia wanted to appear to be reasonable and civilized and open to diplomacy, even as it pursues its military objections on the territory of Ukraine. Accordingly, both sides sent to these negotiations parties which are not at the highest level and were more for show than for substance. In the case of the Russians, it was headed by the former Minister of Culture, Medinsky, who has no reputation whatsoever in dealing with international affairs such as this. He looked very well. He has a good suit, and I'm sure he meant well. But to believe that he could be capable of a breakthrough in negotiations and with the Ukrainian side, which also was not headed by...
Belarusian President praised Ms. Medinsky as a very strong and brilliant negotiator.
Medinsky is a very strong Russian patriot, and he showed that during his tenure as the Minister of Culture. However, that does not make you an international negotiator. He was holding up the Russian side He looked good for the television cameras, and that's about all you could or should expect from those particular talks. It is good that the sides can sit down together in a civilized way, and I hope it will proceed that way, because the alternative is quite ugly. However, to look at the big picture, the Russians have in no way achieved the military victory or they come close to forcing the Ukrainian side to accept their endgame solutions, which they stated very concisely as denazification and demilitarization, turning Ukraine into a neutral state, to which they added in the last few days a third condition, namely recognition of the Russian possession permanently and forever of the Crimea. Those terms are still unacceptable to the Ukrainian side because they are not yet convinced that they have lost this war. The war has been pursued in a very specific way by the Russians for a number of reasons, not least of which this war is in a way a fratricidal war. It is a war between two nations that are very close, peoples that are very close, who are extensively intermarried and who have relatives on the other side of the border. And for those considerations, the Russian authorities were very careful not to do what the Americans do typically in their style of war, which is shock and awe, to come in and destroy everything in their path and everyone in their path, both civilians and combatants. That's how the Americans behaved in Afghanistan. That's how the Americans behaved in Iraq. And these are wars that America lost, even without consideration that there were very few relatives of the peoples they were attacking in the United States, whereas Russia is pursuing military action in a country where a lot of people have relatives. People in reading the Western newspapers, you would think that the sanctions that have been imposed on Russian oligarchs could change the Putin regime, could do something to destabilize and produce a regime change in Russia. That is only a demonstration of how little Western political analysts and Russian Western leaders understand the nature of Russia. The greater challenge or threat to the stability in Moscow would be widespread popular dissatisfaction with the conduct of a brutal war against a country where so many people have relatives.
Mm-hmm. The Western media and the Western government, they precipitately threatened the society with the Russian attack, with Russian aggression, and this accusation fueled panic and hysteria. But it seems that such a decisive move from Russian side was a complete surprise to them. Is it really so?
Well, the President Biden, in answer to some journalists' questions, explained that he trusted American intelligence. Unfortunately, that is a mistaken trust. American intelligence was very clearly misled by superior Russian intelligence, who fed through Estonia, through Poland, and through other intermediary countries, word of an impending Russian attack, which Washington immediately picked up as if it were God-given and true. It wasn't God-given and true. It was intended and used by Moscow to expose Washington's completely unprofessional intelligence operations. And they did that. Even the journalists in D.C. attending Biden's press conferences were laughing behind his back at the completely foolish statements that he was saying about impending Russian invasion. Well, finally, the invasion did come, or incursion, as you want to call it, did come. But when it came, it was indeed a surprise. And Washington had so frequently called wolf in the preceding 2 weeks that nobody believed that it would take place. It did. And it took place in the early morning hours, 4:30 local time, at a time when civilians would not be on the streets, at a time when casualties would be negligible, if at all. on the civilian side. And so it did come, despite all of the warnings of its being impending in the preceding 3 weeks, it finally came and was a surprise.
And what's your opinion? Do you think that Russia really wants to occupy Ukraine?
No, occupation is out of the question. And the best example of this, of Russia's intentions with respect to the future of Ukraine, and I must say at the outset that the Russia's intentions of the end game have been changing and will change according to the nature of the forces on the ground, and how they actually resolve the military challenge will shape the end result. But as a general observation, it is fairly obvious that Russia wants regime change in Ukraine, possibly to divide Ukraine into three parts, a large part of Ukraine with capital in Kiev being both ethnic Russian and ethnic Ukrainian, in a government of tolerance in which both majority and minority populations feel comfortable. That is one possibility, a very large Ukraine, with a Western Ukraine, which is the cradle of the extreme nationalists who are presently in power and have been in power since the coup d'etat of February 2014, the center being Lviv, where to which Americans and other embassies evacuated. That could possibly be another state of Ukraine, which will very quickly be brought into NATO and into the EU, and the Russians will have no objections, because that type of the Ukraine, a landlocked Ukraine, which is removed at some greater distance, several hundred kilometers to the west of the present center of Ukraine in Kiev, will pose no particular military threat, any greater than NATO forces in Slovakia or in Poland do to Russia. So there you have it. What happens now to the two republics, the Donbas republics, Lugansk and Donetsk? I think it's very important to point out that Russia has given very limited news coverage to its military operation in Ukraine. Virtually the only coverage that you see on Russian television for the last few days has been the movement, the progressive movement of the forces, the local forces of Donetsk and Lugansk against their enemies, of mainly the Ukrainian national forces and the special battalions of radicals, and the recovery of town by town of the parts, the greater part of the territory of each of these republics when they were still oblasts or regions of Ukraine that were lost in 2014 and 15 to superior Ukrainian military forces. And when the line of demarcation was made, which became the basis of the Minsk Accords, these majority territories of the former republics were outside their control. In the past few days, we have seen them progressively, the local forces, take back these territories with only minor Russian assistance. Why is that so? I think it's a very important factor. First of all, for Russians in Russia, they see that the local peoples in these republics are fighting for their own freedom and are not being given this freedom on a silver platter by Moscow. That is important for these republics also, for their self-awareness and for their pride, that they were not just neutral observers while Russia restored them their territory. They have restored their territory by their own forces, by their own sacrifices of their fighters, and they will be well prepared from the bottom up to be independent countries, independent of Russia. That is a major point which nobody in the Western media pays attention to.
Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko, who is involved in this conflict by organizing the meeting in Belarus and also knowing the nature of such tensions, he stressed that Ukraine could avoid the escalation of this conflict, but did nothing. It really seems that Russia has been repeatedly provoked by assaulting on self-proclaimed republics, by not implementing Minsk agreements to drag the country into the conflict deeper. Isn't it so?
Yes, it's clearly the case. And I think that President Lukashenko's joining this campaign, first of all, by inviting in Russian military, hosting them as they prepared themselves for the eventuality of an incursion into Ukraine, was of decisive importance in guiding the Kremlin on its military strategy and on its likely outcome of the conflict. The possibility of Belarus participation directly in the operations in Ukraine is, I'm sure, a very great comfort, not only because of the real physical contribution, but because of the moral contribution at a time when Russia is facing a barrage of information and economic warfare attacks coming from the West. So your president and your country have been an important factor in the way this war is being conducted and in its likely outcome.
I don't think that Russia was provoked by the West to start this military operation.
Yes, that is the case. And I'm sure there are a lot of propagandists in the State Department, in the American political establishment, who take comfort that their plans have played out, that Russia's emphasis in December, when it laid out its complaints about the security architecture in Europe, have been put to a side, and that all attention is now proceeding on the conflict in Ukraine. That surely was not what the Russians wanted, although Moscow did everything possible to prepare for such a conflict, both diplomatically, in the world at large. For example, the visits of President Putin both to Delhi in India and to Beijing in China in preparation for what we now see. But that was not their first preference. It was clearly the first preference of Washington to bait Moscow and to provoke it into a military action. But that's happened. It's now water over the dam. I think there is a high likelihood of Russian military success, although they are in the process of changing their tactics and indeed their strategy for victory as they see the results on the ground. There's been a lot of talk in Western media based on very little evidence because there's so much secrecy about the way these military activities are being carried on. But there is the expression by supposed experts, and even by real experts, on military affairs in the West, that the Russians have gone very slowly and have encountered greater resistance than expected. I think there's a lot of truth in that. The Russian strategy was based on its ability to separate the professional Ukrainian military from the radicals, the Azov Battalion, and the other gangsters or jihadists of the kind that Mr. Putin denounced and said would be subject to a denazification campaign. Well, it turns out that after 8 years, with a lot of assistance from American and other NATO instructors, the Ukrainian military has been able to impose much greater discipline on soldiers and officers than existed in 2014. Moreover, I think there is reason to believe that very much the way in the early Soviet Union, the Communist Party took control at the unit level in its military through policy coordinators, through Communist Party zealots who threatened immediate execution for anyone who disputed or discussed orders. I think a similar thing has happened in Ukraine, so that the ability to separate the sheep and the goats, the bad bad soldiers from the very bad soldiers, has been diminished. And in that situation, I think the Russians are slowly, or maybe not so slowly, changing both strategy and tactics. We will see today, tomorrow, whether this is so. Now that the so-called cauldron or surrounding of the Ukrainian Azov battalion and other irregulars, as well as regular military forces in the area of Mariupol, reaches its culmination, and the first direct battle engagements between Russian army and these ultra-nationalists takes place. I think it is likely that there will be complete surrounded, and the combatants will be given a choice of surrendering or fighting to the death. We'll see how that plays out, and how it plays out in Mariupol will be a very good indication of Russian strategy and tactics going forward in the rest of Ukraine.
This conflict shows the shifts in the balance of world powers, and don't you think that this conflict will lead to a transformation of unipolar world into multipolar one? Maybe this is quite a painful transformation, but it is taking place.
I think you're very correct in that assessment. We are witnesses to history, a kind of history that you see once in a generation. In the 1990s, I was a witness to history when I was working for 10 years in Moscow and St. Petersburg. There was no question, but what I saw around me in Moscow was of momentous importance. It was 70 years of a spring, main spring, being wound and wound and wound. And then at one moment in the early 1990s, the spring was let loose, and you had a flow of events that were many times faster than history usually unfolds. We are today witnessing the same thing on the global level. Russia is standing bravely or foolishly, it depends on your perspective, as the champion of a multipolar world against the world's single hegemon, the United States. All of Europe snapped to attention. I was asked on an interview yesterday why the United States has pursued NATO when the objectives of NATO should have been conclusively won when the Soviet Union broke up. And I answered, today, I think that your listeners should consider that a kind of image which crossed America and the world in the last year, coming from the murder, brutal murder of one black man that brought about the BLM, the Black Lives Matter movement. And that is the image of the knee to the neck. The United States has its knee to the neck of Europe in the form of NATO. Through NATO and through this stranglehold on Europe, the United States has its knee to the neck to the world. If the Russians are successful in moving, in forcing the United States to withdraw its knee to the neck of Europe, that will have enormous consequences for the entire world. The beneficiaries will be not only China, who are the obvious first beneficiaries, but virtually every country in the world will benefit from there being a more equitable distribution of global power among the countries, the major powers in particular, who sit at the board of directors table of the world.
So thank you very much for this conversation. We really appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure.
Well, there you have it. Two perspectives on the conflict in Ukraine that you won't hear anywhere else but here on your community radio stations, which are WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM and WGRNLP 94.1 FM, both in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis. The program is Conscious Voices, and I will see you all again next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.